the Music Van Studios, which I had and redid about 5 times. There was everything custom, everything wonderful, and tweaked, and it was great. You could just listen, mix, take it out, and you had something. The studio is long gone, but I'm still here and bringing in the keys. I feel the same, where I hear it, I mix it, I send it out, and it's all fine.
Hey everybody, it is All You Ever Think About Is Sparks. This is episode 31, the only and therefore best podcast devoted to the musical career of Ron and Russell Male. And I'm joined again today by Mr. Monty Mallon. Hi, Monty.
Hello. How are you today, Christian?
Doing great, man. Long time no see. I think it may be somewhere around 24 hours.
Yeah, I think it's been 24 hours to the minute. And then there was a few months you were busy with a play, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we were doing a version of a Romeo and Juliet here in Austin. It was I played Lord Montague. I've aged into all the parental roles now, and there's no going back.
So but, how did it go?
It went really well. Well, there were hiccups and there were acts of God. So here in our part of Texas, there tends to be a big freeze, usually in early February, which is what happened this time. And we don't really have the infrastructure to deal with it because it only happens like once a year. Anyway, so we had a major freeze, and there's a giant live oak that sort of the branches hang over the theater. And after the freeze, the branches fell down and they fell onto the roof of the theater and they fell onto the one power cable going into the theater. So we had to reschedule some days, and then we nearly had a fire in the booth, and just, it was, you know, it was all kinds of stuff. It was like a Scottish play type of curse, but it was for Romeo and Juliet.
But you came through it. You came through it in flying colors, no doubt.
It was great. Thanks for asking. Yeah, had a great time. Right. So now back in the saddle. I would like to mention the podcast conversation that we had yesterday with Mr. Larry Graves. He was nice enough to invite us.
Yeah, that was great. That was a lot of fun. He got three of us together to talk Sparks.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, we could have gone on for quite a long time, I think.
Definitely. I have to admit, I did have a little bit of imposter syndrome because the three of you guys, your fandom goes way back. So I was just interested hearing about y'all's experiences seeing all the myriad shows that you had seen, you know, going back to 74, 75 or whatever.
Well, just compare yourself to all the fans who came in after the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, well, you're real old school.
Yeah, I guess so. Or middle school, at least, right? Yeah, so we did Larry Graves' show, and that should be released soon. We'll make sure to provide a link for you guys so that you can watch that.
Yeah, it was great.
So what else is new? Well, in Sparksdom, in case you've been under a rock as a Sparks fan, there was a new single that was just released and a new video a few days ago. The girl is crying in her latte. I know you've had a chance to see it. Do you have any first impressions?
Well, you know, usually when I hear a song first, I'll give you two thoughts. One is when I hear a song first, I usually don't know quite what to make of it. But this one, it grabbed me right away. I just liked it from the start.
Cool.
The second thing is I've become a strong adherent over the years of waiting to really hear how these songs sound in the context of the albums.
I saw that you had posted that on Facebook, and I had posted something almost those exact words elsewhere in that thread. So when I read that from you, I made sure to heart it because I feel exactly the same way. It was an interesting choice for a first single, I thought. It's I feel like they've gotten into this mode, maybe, you know, spurred on by Annette, among other things. It's definitely arresting, but it doesn't have your typical verse chorus song structure. It's almost atonal. I don't think there's much in the way of modulation or key changes or even chord changes. I really like the buzzy electronic production, which kind of harkens back to, you know, an earlier era of their stuff. I like the sound of it a lot. The video with Kate Blanchett, if you're not already familiar, it's all shot in one. It's just one shot. It's one shot, one take. And you've got Ron and Russ on either side in the background of Kate Blanchett. Kate Blanchett is front and center, and she's wearing a yellow suit that looks like something that I could imagine Russell wearing. And there's just, well, check it out. She's dancing. They're not doing much behind them. Ron is doing Ron's thing. I think he gets up to clear his table at one point.
There's really an absurdist element to it, because it's just them in the background, her dancing in front, and nothing else.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. And in the conversation we had with Larry, Joe Seeger made the point that even in that context, Ron steals the show.
He always does.
If you watch him, he really does.
Yeah.
So it's a fine little video, and it's fun.
Yeah, I keep getting reminded of a quote that Ron gave years and years and years ago near the beginning of their career, when he said that he was frustrated that he couldn't perform like a Pete Townsend, you know, or something like that at his keyboard. So he decided if he couldn't go crazy, then he would go completely sane and hopefully appear even crazier. In many cases, it worked. So,
and thus the haircut.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm looking forward to the rest of that album. Have you pre-ordered yours?
No, I will. I will. I'll listen to it as soon as I can. You know, I always want to resist listening to the singles, but I never can.
Yeah,
I always end up listening to them. But I you know, I kind of miss the days of like, wow, here's an album. I guess I'm dating myself. You know, wow, here's an album, and putting it on and just taking it all in. And I remember with Exotic Creatures of the Deep, I got it in the UK, and I was able to get it onto my whatever it was, Walkman type device back in 2008. And I was on an airplane trip, and I got to just listen to it. Oh, you know, on the airplane coming back. And I got to just listen to it over and over and over. And I just fell in love with it as an album without thinking about any particular song right away. And I miss that, you know, but so that's why I look forward to the album so much.
Well, it's like sitting down for like a 4 or 5 course meal. You know, it's all laid out carefully in front of you, you know, as opposed to just when you're listening to random singles. It's like kind of like being at a tapas bar. You know, there's maybe momentarily satisfying, but not for long. And, you know, you don't have the greater, you know, there's not a greater a picture or aesthetic whole or, you know, whatever. So I'm with you.
Yeah, for all we know, we were having the little bit of sherbet that you have in between courses, you know. So
exactly.
Palette. Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. If that's the highlight of the album, that'll be one thing. But it sounds like it could be part of a very consistent, very effective, almost new direction for them. But it's too early to say.
I'd be very excited.
Context. So we'll see.
I'd be very excited to hear a new direction. So the last time we spoke on this podcast, we interviewed Mr. Jim Goodwin, who became a touring member of Sparks during the Womp tour, and then he was later brought into the band as one of the Gleaming Spires guys. What did you get out of that
He was just really such a great guy. I mean, you know, he has this amazing history. He was with a couple other bands that were very well known. And I don't think he's known mostly for outside of Sparks circles for his work with Sparks. But he really valued that time. And it was so much fun to listen to him. And you know, the way he talked about the other band members, the way he talked about Ron and Russell. I remember one thing he said that really struck me was he was listed as additional keyboards on Angst in My Pants. But he said, I was in the studio, but I don't think I played anything.
Really?
I don't think anything I recorded made it on the album.
See? God, that's so funny.
What a great quote that
really,
is.
Really down to earth guy. I felt similarly when I was interviewing Dave Kendrick. I mean, they're just normal guys who got good at their craft and they were driven and they also happened to get very lucky being at the right place at the right time. You know,
yeah, he said some very nice things about David Kendrick and his influence on the band during these years. And I know we're going to be talking about that and I'm looking forward to that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So that was great. Hopefully we can get him back on soon. As well as the other members of Gleaming Spires. I'd like to have David back on again. Would love to get Les Boehm. I think Les Boehm is gettable. So while we're concentrating on that era of Sparks, it would be great to get everybody in there.
So has Bob Haig just dropped out of the picture in
some
way?
That's my understanding. Yeah. He's MIA, according to those who would be in the know. Yeah.
Which is not me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we have a mutual Facebook friend who has some sort of relationship with the guys in Gleaming Spires, but nah, he's MIA as far as I know. So anybody out there, if you're listening to this and you happen to know Bob Haig or know someone who knows him, we would love to get in touch with him.
That would certainly be great. That would certainly be great. But I was happy, you know, I thought it was great talking with Jim, and hearing from the other guys will be great too. And I think one of the points that they talked about, which we talked about too, was that Jim talked about, which we talked about too, is how the music live got better and better, even as the band's involvement was diminishing over the course of those records.
That was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something David Kendrick had said a while ago. And you could definitely see it on the videos. You can just see how good they were.
It makes me want to hear a live album from 83 or 84 or something like that. Something that's divorced from the, I guess you could call it a sterile production on those couple of albums.
Well, that kind of leads us to Womp, because there was one thing we talked about with Jim.
Good segue.
Which, a segue, you like that?
Yeah.
That's professional podcasting.
Well done, well done.
Yeah, but... Now I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yeah. That, you know, one thing I raised with him and he agreed on was that Womp, it just has that raw feel that you and I have talked about. And the more I thought about it, it just seems like they wanted to play live and they put these songs together in a way that could be made bigger and liver, you know, and they weren't as concerned with, you know, crossing every T and dotting every I in the studio. They were more concerned, it seemed to me, with just getting these songs out there. Because how long had it been since they played live?
They hadn't put a band together since Big Beat.
Yeah.
So 5 years.
Yeah, and look how much they tour. They love to be on the road, and here they were.
When we were chatting with Larry yesterday, I had mentioned this sort of manifesto, I guess, that Ron had come up with around the Island Records era. He called it jam-proofing your compositions, and he had a long list of rules, things to do or not to do, because he and Russ were very conscious about not falling into... They didn't want to play blues. They were very anti-blues and they were anti-folk. So, and against improvising in a jam type of way. But when you hear an album like this, where most, if not all of the songs really are just come to life from sketches, of lyrical sketches, musical sketches, and they really sort of let their instincts carry the day. And that goes for the band, the Gleaming Spires guys as well. I think they have a lot more influence over the sound of the records that they're on than I think some previous bands, incarnations of Sparks have had.
I would agree with that. And there's something else that you said that has really stuck with me and has really, after all these years, really changed the way I listen to the album, that every single song has a fascinating character in it. And it's every single song.
Oh, you're right.
You're right. You said it.
I'm right.
You said it, and it got me thinking. And every single song has some character who's telling a little piece, a little vignette of his story, you know, or playing it out. And I think that's, you know, I don't want to repeat myself from the first one, but I think that is such a great observation. And I think it's such a clever way to go about an album.
There was a review, a contemporaneous review. I don't remember what publication it was in, but they likened it to a series of B movies all told within the span of 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, sure. Don't Shoot Me could be a classic film noir, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know it. You know it. You know it. You know it. For sure.
That's great.
So, of course, we are going to talk about the second half of Womp That Sucker today. And we're also going to pick up where we left off in the story of Sparks around that time, which, frankly, there isn't a whole lot to talk about between the release of Womp and when they went back into the studio to work on Angst. Everything was done within a fairly condensed period of time. But, you know, they did do a few things. One thing that I wanted to go ahead and talk about, because I didn't think I did when we did part one, is to mention the producer, the guy who produced this album and produced Angst, I think just those two. And that's Reinhold Mack. Now, Reinhold Mack, he's a name that I remember from when I was a kid, and this is going to come up again a little bit later. I was a massive Queen fan. And of course, you know, as you know, the SS Sparks and the HMS Queen or whatever had been ships passing in the night a few times, at least in the earlier parts of their career. And one place where they overlap is this producer, Reinhold Mack. In fact, I do believe that both Queen and Sparks were in Munich working on albums that came out around that time at that time. So it's interesting for me as an old Queen fan and now current Sparks fan to hear similarities, sonic similarities between those contemporaneous albums, between those two bands. In many ways, albums like Womp and Angst sound like bizarro versions of the Queen records that I grew up with from that same era.
To what extent? I mean, you know, maybe the later Queen albums, the ones after Sheer Heart Attack, mm-hmm. and, you know, like Night at the Opera, maybe there's some similarities, but the early Queen albums were real hard rock.
Yeah.
You know, they really featured some great guitar work and things.
Well, yeah, you can't beat Brian May. No, you're right about that. This particular era is interesting. And again, I have to wonder how much Mack had to do with it. Because if you listen to Womp, Angst, and then around that time, Queen had The Game, you know, which had that was their Back to Basics album. It was very drum and bass heavy, a lot more simple, pared down, as are those two Sparks albums that we've been talking about. I do have a comparison that I'm going to bring up a little bit later. There, one of the songs we're going to talk about, I think there's almost a rough analog to a Queen song that came out on the record that they were working on in Munich while Sparks was also working on Womp That Sucker. And who knows? We'll see if you hear the same thing that I've heard.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. Sounds good.
So
yeah, I loved Queen until they started doing stuff like bicycle race. I actually saw them a couple times.
Did you?
With my friends. Yeah. And way back in the day. And I loved them. But when it started to get into Fat Bottom Girls and Bicycle Race, that's when I just kind of lost it.
Too campy.
Yeah, it was like, you know, they were so good. I just really loved the sound they had on those first three albums in particular.
A lot of
those are great albums. Every one of them.
Completely agree. Mac, he is German. He was born somewhere in then West Germany, 1949. He was a classically trained pianist and then guitarist from an early age. Always wanted to be a sound engineer. He happened to get a job at Musicland Studios, which was owned and run by Giorgio Moroder in the late 60s, early 70s. And during the 70s, he produced or was an engineer on lots of really well-known records from some big names. Five albums, I think, by ELO. He did a couple of Rolling Stones. I had a whole list here, T-Rex. So by the time Sparks came into the studio, you know, he did have a name for himself. He doesn't. Now, his biography, I can't find very much. He apparently is a very private person. I did find a really interesting interview with him where he talks about his experiences producing various acts that he had worked on over the years. And I was so disappointed because he doesn't mention Sparks once. He gushes over Queen and Freddie Mercury. He even named his third son, gave him the middle name Frederick. Not a word about Ron and Russ, which I thought was very disappointing.
I would agree with you on that.
So the album was released, I think it was in May 1981. That's what I keep coming up with.
Yeah, that's what I've seen before too.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree with you, and I think we looked that up and mentioned it last time, so I'm pretty sure it was May.
Good friend of the pod, Ruud Swart, who ran the Dutch Sparks fan club for many years, actually got to meet Ron and Russ just a little bit before the release of Womp That Sucker in March of 1981. They were in Belgium. And he writes about this in chapter 10 of his albums project. And of course, this one is about Womp That Sucker. I thought this was kind of cute. And since we both know him, I thought I would just kind of share this real quickly. He was 19 years old at the time. In 1981, I was running the fan mail organization, releasing both a Dutch and English edition of a fanzine. I had quite a good relationship with Ariola, the record company that was putting out Sparks Records and the Benelux. They informed me that Sparks would be part of the French language television show Génération 80, however you say that in French, at the studios in Brussels. Upon my request, they arranged for me to be present there and meet the band. So here he is, 19, about to meet his heroes. March 21, 1981, I went to Brussels with fellow Sparks fan Ruud, Speck, and we spent about 3 or 4 hours with Ron and Russell and Leslie Boehm, the only one from the band who had come with them to Belgium. The other members portrayed as Sparks were local models, which is pretty funny. They did Tips for Teens, or rather, and sort of Tops of the Pops fashion. They lip-synced. And then when it was over, they all sat down at a sofa in front of a TV that was playing Laurel and Hardy in a loop over and over, which is awfully appropriate, I would say, for Sparks. This is the conversation that Ruud ended up having with Russell and Ron, this nervous 19-year-old unsure what to say to his heroes. They asked him what he thought of the new album. I guess it had leaked and he was privy to it. He had heard it. And Ruud said, I think that this album is, I don't know whether it's going to be a hit record. It's typical Sparks. That's the problem. To which Russell laughs out loud. Ron laughs. I know, Ruud. It's pretty good, but it's not very commercial. Russell, you don't think so? Looking surprised. And Les says, oh, yes, it is. Ruud, well, commercial. I mean, for the fans, for sure. Russell, looking worried for the fans. Rud, the fans will love it. Ron, well, come back in 6 months when it's a gold album in England. It was a softball. It was a softball, Rud.
Yeah, wow. Was that about Womp or was that about Angst?
It was about Womp. It was
about Womp.
He does so, add, as an addendum, he did meet them 6 months later at a venue in Belgium, but that gig had been canceled at the last minute due to low attendance. In fact, the record, of course, was never a gold.
No, he was, I guess in a lot of ways, he was right. It was very big in L.A., as you and I have talked about quite a bit.
Right.
But it did not capture, you know, the British audience at all. I think at that point they had moved on from Sparks. And that certainly didn't get them back as far as I can remember.
No. What's interesting about the UK and the release of that album is, because of course years prior, they had a great relationship with the British press and, you know, with music fans there and everything. So they gave it another shot. This album was carried by RCA, and over in the UK, it was handled by a subsidiary called Wi-Fi Records. And when the album was released, they had this really weird promotional event. I probably did mention this last time. On May 6th, in fact, there's an invitation that went out from Wi-Fi Records, and it reads the following: Wi-Fi Records invite you to take a ringside look at the first signing, Sparks. A warm-up bout will be followed by the Mail Brothers going the distance on Wednesday, 6 May, at the Hilton Hotel, Park Lane. Ron and Russell will be promoting their knockout new album over 3 rounds, Womp That Sucker. Buffet drinks for fight fans between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. So they staged an actual boxing match in the ballroom of the Hilton there in London, hoping to attract enough attention and crowds so that the new album would get some traction that way. In case I didn't mention it last time, yes, they did play 3 rounds. They were actually hitting each other. Ron won by, a technical knockout, although he said he broke a rib during that fight.
Well, you know, it does raise an interesting question about why weren't they able to resonate again in the UK like they once had? Because they were kind of returned to the form that had worked for them in the past, you know, kind of the shorter, punchier singles, moving away from the disco stuff and whatever the other album, Terminal Jive, was.
Right.
And actually, that was the more disco of the two albums. But you get my point. Moving away from all that, getting back into that pop context of 3.5, 4 minute songs. I wonder why it didn't resonate. Was it just that the UK had moved on at that point and music had moved on from the UK perspective?
Or was it something? Feeling
that,
especially at that time, the UK music audience, pop and rock audience were pretty fickle. I don't know. It's a good point. Of course, there was that backlash against their going electronic/disco. Many of the UK fans didn't cotton to that at all. But by 1981, you've got this huge new romantic explosion. You've got people like, you know, Gary Numan and Flock of Seagulls and OMD and Depeche Mode coming out and being huge. And
I think that's a really good point that in the first wave, in the 75, there was Roxy Music, a couple others, you know, some glam acts. They really stood out. There weren't other people who were doing what they were doing. But by the time 1981 came around, you really had a new wave. Mm-hmm. And by then you had a lot of acts that were putting something new and different out there. And they just got lost in the shuffle, I guess.
So you're saying that maybe there wasn't enough in their sound on that album to differentiate themselves from all the other stuff that was on the airwaves that was of a similar genre?
Well, it's probably Hoist by Their Own Petard, because any Sparks fan will agree, when you listen to Kimono or Propaganda or Indiscreet, there's just nothing like them.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, they're just in a world of their own. But as great as Womp is, and it's one of my top 5 or 10 Sparks albums without question, it was an effort to be more in sync with the music trends of the time.
Good point.
So there were so many other alternatives by then, it didn't really have to necessarily stand out in the UK. And they got the big boost from being in LA.
There you go.
K-Rock.
There you go. So that's
the rest of the country, not so much.
For the first time in their careers, they were doing better in the States, albeit very regional and localized, you know, to the LA area. But I think it was the first time that they were more popular in the States than they were abroad.
Yeah, but I don't think that really happened until Sparks in Outer Space, when they had the single with Jane Wiedlin.
Mm-hmm.
But they were always on American Bandstand.
That's true, too. Yeah,
and they were on Saturday Night Live with,
Danny DeVito.
They were starting, they were getting some recognition in the States, for sure, I guess you could say.
So a lot of that exposure that they had in the LA area was due to K-Rock, the FM radio station. And actually, they had been, they were a country and western station for a long time until a new owner took over in 1979. And he decided this station is going to be about this thing called New Wave. And so you start hearing bands like XTC and Oingo Boingo and some of the other ones that we mentioned before. And the Sparks' new sound slotted so well with those other acts and those other songs. And K-Rock promoted the hell out of Sparks. And at one point, they had in their regular rotation 4 songs from Womp That Sucker. And it's not just the 2 singles. They had a couple of others.
That's amazing. I actually have a friend who I just discovered was in L.A. at that time. And she was telling me that they were just it.
Really?
People swamped to their shows. They loved them. Yeah.
I was reading here regarding those shows in the wake of the release of Womp. So their longtime manager, Joseph Fleury, he had convinced the guys to do a show at the Whiskey A Go-Go, where they were doing shows way back at the mm-hmm. very beginning of their career as Sparks, and even Half Nelson, I think. He convinced them to play at the Whiskey A Go-Go before they started their French tour. If you recall, of course, they were huge in France for the better part of 1980 because of the When I'm With You single. And they had already secured an agreement for several gigs that they would end up playing in France. So they were ready to head out there and promote this album. But they ended up doing a show at the Whiskey A Go-Go. It was sold out. So they added 2 more shows. Those sold out as well. This was all in October of 1981. The interesting part is that the crowd didn't seem to recognize any of their old songs. There are a bunch of Los Angelinos who thought that Sparks was a brand new wave act.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess that's, also a remnant of the pre-internet era. Because these days, if I hear a song by a new band that I've never heard of, I'm going to Google it and I'll find everything about them.
Well, that's really interesting, because I'm sure I recall either we were talking or somewhere we made the point that David Kendrick made an effort to incorporate a couple of the older songs into their stage act.
Yeah.
And I wonder how that was received. If what you're saying is true, mm-hmm. then I would assume that, people were kind of like, yeah, that sounds okay. But they really wanted to hear the Willies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Willies. Oh boy. Yeah, and that's the first one that we're gonna talk about.
I'm segueing again.
It's a great segue. I'm okay,
showing off my podcasting skills once again.
All right. Well, I'm going to finish up talking about the promotional events that they had for the remainder of that year. Of course, you mentioned American Bandstand. They sure as heck did go on American Bandstand in 81, again with Dick Clark. Womp ended up climbing to 182 on the U.S. album charts, and I think that's the highest they had ever achieved in the U.S. album charts. There were 8 shows that were booked in France. Unfortunately, 4 of those were canceled due to low ticket sales. There were 6 dates in Belgium booked, but 4 of those were canceled there too. So they actually didn't really have much of a tour, just a few isolated gigs in Europe. And then to top off their mini tour of Europe, they had a really interesting appearance on German TV. There was this event called Rock und Klassiknacht. And this was a live show at the Circus Kron. At that event, there were other contemporaneous acts like OMD. There's Tangerine Dream, Peter Hamill. This was on December 9th, 1981. What was most memorable about that particular show was that it happened to take place 1 year to the date of the assassination of John Lennon. So all of the bands, everybody who was there to play a set, they all got together on stage. You know about this?
Yeah.
They all got together on stage and they played what I read characterized as an odd rendition of John Lennon's "Give Peace a Chance." Apparently, Ron, seeing so many other keyboardists playing during that number, opted to play "The Banana" instead. And says Dave Kendrick, "That was the end of the show. We were all playing. Ron playing the banana. It was strange to say the least." After that, they scurried back over to Munich and to Musicland Studios to work on Angst. But you knew about that strange event?
It wasn't in the front of my brain, but when you mentioned it, absolutely, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, that was really funny.
Sure, it's in one of the books.
All right. You did a great job of segueing us, and then I drifted off course again, but we're back.
No, it's a great story, and the great imagery of Ron playing the banana.
I know.
You can't pass that up.
I do think there's a photo of that somewhere. I'll see if I can find it and post it somewhere. So, side B, side 2 of Womp That Sucker. We got 5 songs here, starting with The Willies.
I am always so impressed with the depth and meaning of this song, that there's so many layers to it, you know.
I can tell that you mean what you say, and there's not an ounce of irony.
Well, it gets, you know, just as a way of prefacing our conversation, it's just to remember where we were coming from when we did part one, which is that our take, and I think you'd agree with me, our take was that this is an album that was just really designed to have some fun.
Totally.
Fun. And there are some moments for sure where they are making some points, but, mm-hmm. you know, The Willies is just a very funny song.
It's funny.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit ambiguous. I mean, I my reading of it is he's got an STD, gonorrhea or something like that. But sonically, man, this is there's so much that word fun. Like I need to shake that loose from my head and find some other synonyms. But it is so much fun. You know, at the very top of the song, that squelching, bassy squelching synth that sounds like somebody's belly grumbling. We'll hear that in a moment. As Russ was thinking, it started on a Tuesday. I think it was that lunch meat. Let's see here. These songs, I want to preface this with this. They're pretty simply composed, in that Ron isn't indulging in a lot of the flights of fancy that he did on earlier records, specifically the Island records and even the ones before that. So, you know, when I'm looking these songs up to try to figure out what key they're in, it usually stays that way. It's pretty consistent. Willie's is an F major. And we have Ron at the very top. He's playing those rhythmic chords in eighths. I mentioned that guttural bass line. Is there anything you wanted to say about the song before I read the lyrics?
No, I mean, I it's, you know, it's never one of my top 10 Spark songs or anything like that, but it's one that's just fun to hear. I love the little drum break that David Kendrick throws in there. And I definitely look forward to that little one-liner from Ron where he says,
I think I know the one.
Yeah. Go ahead. What is it? Maybe he's lax. You know what I'm saying? I'm looking for it here.
I was thinking of a different one.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Let's go through it and let's give people morally. He's lax. That's what it is. Morally. He's lax. Yeah. It's such a great, wonderful little song.
Here it is. It started on a Tuesday. It must have been that lunch meet. I haven't been intimate. And anyway, I'm careful. We know what you got, boy. We know what you got, boy. We know what you got, boy. They call it the Willies. They call it the Willies. And Russ's voice has this hilarious warble. They call it the Willies. You can see him shaking his hands and eyes bulging out. You shiver
shivering and shaking. Yep.
Doing Swan Lake. All over the place. Ron with the imagery, man. Has everyone gone Christian? Well, glory, hallelujah, but I'm beyond salvation. I haven't caught a prayer. The Willies do this to you. The Willies do this to you. The Willies do this to you. They call it the Willies. They call it the Willies. It's hard to explain, like Citizen Kane, to someone who's blind. That's my favorite couplet right there. That's a great joke.
There's just so many interesting thoughts running around his brain, you know?
Yeah. they call it the Willies. You shiver and shake, you're doing Swan Lake all over the place. And then there's a sort of a breakdown or a middle eight. We know what you got, boy. We know what you got, boy. We know what you got, boy. Physically, I'm splendid. Mentally, I'm splendid. Morally, he is lax. And maybe
that's the problem.
We know what you got, boy. We know what you got, boy. We know what you got, boy. What you got? They call it the Willies. They call it the Willies. You shiver and shake. You're doing Swan Lake all over the place. And they repeat and repeat and repeat and fade out.
At the very end, he sings, I'm speaking Chinese. Oh. I'm swinging from trees. I'm wearing your gowns.
Thank you. Thank you for catching that. That is a good one.
Who knows what, you know... You know, it just shows you what's going on in his mind. There's so many wonderful little allegories he makes, little references to things, but he makes them work. They all fit in the song. You know, Citizen Kane to someone who's blind. Okay, I got that.
Sure. Yeah.
If you've seen the movie, yeah, it'll be a hard one to explain to someone who's blind.
Exactly. Yeah. one of my little favorite jokes. That could just be a throwaway joke, but it's funny. I like it. It's part of what makes this album so charming. You're not going to be digging deep, you know, for anything very, very deep, but you will come across these delightful little jokes, these bon mots of Ron.
It's their funniest album, in my humble opinion. And, you know, it really is so different. It, you know, the structure might be similar to what they did in the 70s, but the point of view is so different. It's so different. You just don't get, you know, it's either take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it, you know, to me it works. And I think somebody else who just loved those 70s albums, a lot of people don't like what they did in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the reasons why I think it works so well is because the band is so good and so tight. And the producer Mac plays to those strengths, and you know it sure does seem that Ron decided, and you know Russ maybe too, that lyrics were going to take a backseat on this album. Like you said before, this is a party album. This is fun, and they hadn't really had an opportunity to just have loosey goosey fun. Maybe Big B a little bit.
I don't know if they've ever put an album where they were just having a little bit of fun, where they, it was just them having fun, you know? And maybe after Terminal Jive and all they went through with that, maybe that's all they wanted to do.
Yeah. Shall we listen?
Sure.
What is it? What are the Willies?
That's never really defined, is it?
No, not at all. Why does it hurt when I pee? Ask Frank Zappa.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's an STD.
That's kind of what I'm getting. Morally lax. Yeah. So the next song on the album is "Don't Shoot Me."
You know, first impression. Way back in the day was, well, this is a good B-side, you know,
yeah.
Good B-side to the single. And I think it was Tips for Teens with "This is the B-side." It's good. But over time, I've really gotten to appreciate this song. which is one of the reasons why I love this album so much. I like every single one of the songs, every single one. Whereas even with Angst, which was always been my classic from this period, there's one or two, they're just, okay, you know, for, in my book, in my book. But on this one, as I've gotten older, I've gotten to appreciate every single song on this album. And this one is a great, this one's a great story. This is the one, this is the film noir song.
This is a, it's a great story. You're right. And I didn't appreciate it the first several times I heard this album. There were always a couple of tracks in there that just weren't, didn't really register with me, but this one finally did take hold, and it is a great story. Safari hunting, bad. Don't do it. I came away with that political message.
Well, certainly not for extended periods.
Right. This is one of those songs, and here we go. This is just going to be a litmus test to see if maybe I'm crazy. This is one of those songs that sounds to me sonically similar to a song by Queen in on the album Hot Space, which came out a matter of months after this. Humor me. I'm going to play a few seconds of Don't Shoot Me, and then I'm going to play a few seconds of Queen's Put Out the Fire that was also produced by Mac at the same time the guys were working on, I believe, actually Angst by then. Let's see here. Don't Shoot Me. Long intro. I gotta hear that chorus. Okay, so Russ is doing his multi-tracked operatic vocals thing, which they had kind of put down for a while. They use it to great effect here. All right, imagine something sort of similar, but a lot bluesier, as Brian May would play it. In fact, he is here. Am I crazy? Do you hear it? Are you hearing any similarities at all between those two?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the tempo is about the same. The beat is kind of very similar in driving it. And I think the common denominator has got to be the producer, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah. You've got Queen and, or rather Freddie and Brian and Roger's voice multi-tracked like that. Does sound an awful lot to me, like what Russ is doing with his army of Russells.
I can hear it, but and they're both very distinctive songs, though, at the same time.
True.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, that's a great comparison.
So what is this song about?
I think it is definitely a warning not to go away for months in the jungle.
I'll buy that.
That's when you have problems.
Where did he possibly get the... My thinking is that they were jamming and this song structure came out and Ron was thinking, sounds like a hippo plodding, trotting through the forest. How about I write something around that?
who knows, maybe he was just thinking about the animals at the time.
Maybe so.
Yeah, who knows? But it's a nice little song, and it definitely has a point, and it certainly is fun to listen to. And as always, the band plays it wonderfully.
So you said
for an unbiased opinion.
You said it reminds you of a film noir.
Oh, just with the I don't want to take the analogy too far. I was just thinking about the wife who shoots the husband at the end.
Oh, right. Gotcha. The song is in A major, and
I don't know if she's a femme fatale or not, but
yeah, I get the feeling that she very well might be. Thought, I guess it was a misreading on my part. I thought that she had shot the hunter. And
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, isn't that what I said?
He came home. I guess so. I think I just misheard you.
Yeah. Well, no, I may have misspoke, but he got shot down just like the animals that he went out and shot, you know, a little irony there.
How do you like that?
How do you like that?
I'm going to read the lyrics. I am a rhino, or would you prefer to read the lyrics? I guess you don't have them handy.
I have them right here in front of me.
Oh, be my guest.
I'll be happy to. I am a, now see, when I read it, I want to start singing it, but
yeah, me too.
I will refrain from embarrassing us in doing that. I am a rhino plotting the jungle. Dinner time's here, and baby, I'm home. Me and my baby, we are so happy. Then I smell vinyl. Darling, let's run. Chorus, don't shoot me. Don't shoot me down. Don't shoot me. Don't shoot me down. And then the hippo speaks up. I am a hippo sloshing through mud. Work is now over. Baby, I'm home. Isn't she lovely? Makes me feel comfy. Everything's going so nicely for the hippo family, right? Then I smell jeeps and darling, let's run. Then it's don't shoot me, don't shoot me down, don't shoot me, don't shoot me down. And then I'm a poor slob. Ah, there I go. I'm a poor slob from Reno, Nevada. I am a hunter of rhinos and hippos. Then I come home from months in the bush. I'm tired. I'm weary. Darling, I'm home. Darling, darling, what's wrong? Darling, darling, what's wrong? Darling, darling, who's he? Don't shoot me. Don't shoot me down. Don't shoot me. Don't shoot me down, down, down. Nice shooting. Nice shooting, dear, dear, dear. Nice shooting. Nice shooting, dear.
I can't believe this escaped me. Like every time I've heard the song, that final verse.
That final verse.
So this poor slump from Reno, Nevada, who could be the same person who is out there in the savannah shooting at hippos and rhinos, comes home to his wife, and I'm guessing she's in bed with another man. She takes out a gun. He's worried that she's going to shoot him and maybe shoots the other paramour instead.
No, I never thought. I guess that's possible. I always thought of it as her shooting him.
Yeah, could, yeah.
Well, you got me.
Yeah, exactly. So many layers.
So many layers. It's so deep. It's such a fun little song. That's all it is.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. All right. So we are now going to play Don't Shoot Me.
We'll be right back.
And then you get to Susie Safety.
Right, Susie Safety.
I will just say, you know, the first two the first two songs of this album are really good, but it's the third, fourth, and then the fifth one that just bring it on home. I've always loved these three songs in a row. And this is something we talked about a little bit on the last one. There's like a continuity to them because That's Not Nastasha goes right into Wacky Women. You know?
That's right, it does. And
yeah, so there's some point here. But Susie Safety, it's such a fun, you know, my wife and I still quote it when we're crossing the street.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we still make little references to it. It's such a wonderful, cute little song. And to me, this is an enduring song of theirs.
Yeah, I think so too. Musically, I like it a lot. It's got a really great lilting beat to it. The lyrics are really interesting. I'm guessing it's the guy has maybe a guardian angel, or maybe it's just his partner, who knows, who keeps him out of danger, out of trouble. Although it seems like near the end of the song, it's starting to ruffle his feathers a bit. And could she just maybe back off? And
well, there's the great verse: when she's near to me and there's no one else around and I can't control myself, she says, "Safety first, pal."
There you go.
That's what brings it all home. Can we just step back though? And we talk a lot about Ron and all he brings, but I guess, you know, it's a reminder once again of just how much Russell is, you know, it's that symbiotic nature of this group and Russell singing what Ron produces and putting his own stamp on it and really making these songs Russell songs. You really hear him sing. So on the Willies and Don't Shoot Me, they're sung in one kind of voice. And then all of a sudden Susie Safety comes and he's singing a whole different register, a whole different lilt to it, you know, and it's so appropriate. For the music, it's just right.
That's such a good point. Russ in general, and he really gets a chance to do it on this album. He's got his silly, goofy voice. And he's got his more serious, down to earth voice.
He's definitely down a couple registers from where he was a few albums back, right?
Yeah, so just
must
in general.
Make it easier for him to actually sing and emote the way he might actually want to.
Right. Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah. Could really work to his advantage. But he's wonderful on this song. Just perfect.
Could not agree more. This song is in D major. There are two bass lines on here. You've got Les Boehm's bass, but more prominent than that, you've got Ron using a synth bass. Ron really gets to have fun with a plethora of different synths. You can tell he's having a good time here. And in fact, he does have a synth solo, which I think is really delightful in the middle of Susie Safety.
It's a wonderful little solo. I agree. We're pretty biased on this album, I think.
True. All right. I'm going to go ahead and take the plunge. I'm going to read these lyrics here. I looked up in the sun and I didn't shade my eyes. I like you, I keep wanting to do it in the rhythm of the song. Then a girl appeared and said, "Here, these are your size. Susie Safety." Susie Safety. That's my Susie. I tried to cross the street and I almost got mowed down, but the softest little hand yanked me back to safer ground. Susie Safety. Susie Safety. That's my Susie. She says no smoking. She says no drink. You should wear a parka. I'm really safe, but I kind of resent Susie Safety. Susie Safety, that's my Susie. Susie Safety, she's my safety. When she's near to me and there's no one else around and I can't control myself, she says, "Safety first, pal." Susie Safety, Susie Safety, that's my Susie. She says, "No speeding and always eat right. Watch your fats and starches." I'm really safe, but I kind of resent Susie Safety. Susie Safety. That's my Susie. Susie Safety. She's my safety. She's safe in my arms and I'm safe in hers. Susie Safety. That's my Susie.
You know, he does a lot of listing on this album, doesn't he? Because it kind of reminds me of Tips for Teens with each of those little tips one after another. That's and here's true. One little I hadn't really thought about
here
it.
Here he's listing all of these near-death experiences, potentially, being saved by Susie, his perceived or actual guardian angel.
Yeah.
And then I guess, you know, near the end, he's realizing, or about halfway through, hey, you know, thanks for keeping me alive and out of trouble, but I sure miss having, you know, my own willpower.
I kind of resent.
Yeah.
I kind of resent.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder if I wanted to, you know, dig deeper into Ron's psyche, maybe that shows his ambivalence toward deep, long-term monogamous relationships. Like, sure, it's probably good for you and keeps you out of trouble, but it can be pretty suffocating after a while.
We know so little after all these years we about do. Their personal
so little.
Life.
Well, all we can, so little. All we can do is pretend they are tea leaves to read.
They're just the Sparks brothers.
Indeed. All right. Here comes Susie Safety.
Safety.
That was awesome.
That was awesome.
Okay, Susie Safety. All right, so now we've got... So you said you kind of consider these final three songs as sort of a suite to close out
only
the album?
Well, there's just something about the way they're all tied together. They're all about a woman, or women, very specifically. And then if you listen to the end of That's Not Nastasia, it goes right into Wacky Women without a break. Mm-hmm. And as we talked about last time, if you listen to Funny Face, it's the same thing with Where's My Girl? It goes mm-hmm. right into Where's My Girl?
Yeah, they overlap a bit.
There's a little bit of an overlap. And that's maybe it's just a little device that he does occasionally on the album. You know, maybe yeah. that's all it is. But it is very interesting, and it does create some kind of continuity. Maybe Susie and Nastasia are just the kind of wacky women this guy just can't resist at the end of the day.
I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Oh, so That's Not Nastasia.
That was pretty damn meta, wasn't it?
That was very meta.
Thank you.
Congratulations. I don't think that the person that we're going to have on this show, Mr. Paul Barrett, will have to quit his day job or anything, but that was very, very impressive.
Yeah. But I always liked the way it just, you know, because That's Not Nastasia has that ending, doon, 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 and it just kind of evolves into this big mess of music. And then you get the coming right out at you. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was nicely done effect.
What an interesting opening. It sounds like a marching beat. And that cascading dong 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 dong. It's really, really dramatic.
It is dramatic, and here's where you start to hear some of the magic that David Kendrick really brings to it, because there's so many interesting little drum parts in this song, and in Wacky Women. But in Wacky Women, they're not quite as pronounced. But in this song, you know, there's this part when it gets later in the song and they're going, that's not Nastasia, that's not Nastasia, that's Nastasia. And the beat is, he keeps the beat, but at the same time, he's changing the beat with the song. And it's really I think it's a real percussive accomplishment to hear how he does it. And when you play the song, you know, that is one that you'll really be able to hear what he does, because Ron is definitely playing with the rhythm. But David just keeps it going in a very consistent way. And somehow that contrast works for this song because it all ends at the same place.
Wow. So are you saying that that David is keeping the same beat and the same tempo, but he's changing the rhythm?
He's keeping the same beat, but he's also it works because of the way Ron writes it and the way he plays it. It ends at the same place. And so somehow he makes it all work and make it sound very coherent. And it took me a long time as a drummer to be able to do what he does there.
Yeah.
Because it sounds so simple, but it's really playing against, you know, just making it mesh with what Ron is doing. I always thought it was one of the cool accomplishments on this record.
I'm so glad you're a drummer, because this is one of those albums that where the drumming and angst, the drumming is so important and drives many of these songs. And I know David Kendrick is a fantastic drummer, but I don't have the vocabulary or really the know-how about drumming to explain why. Are there other songs on either side of this album where David's drumming is unique or unusual or anything that really stands out to you?
The drumming is just solid throughout the whole thing. Tips for Teens is certainly a case that has some interesting drumming. Wacky Women we'll talk about, because I had a really cool conversation with him when I interviewed him. But it's on the next album that I think he really becomes the forefront of that album in a lot of ways. So, but yeah, on this song is one that I've always liked his drumming. And on the next one, Wacky Women, I always thought that he did a really wonderful job. And we'll talk about that when we get to it. But yeah, this one I always thought was a good one, a good David Kendrick number.
I want to get one thing out of the way real quickly. According to Ron, we had met because Natasha, it's 1981. You may be thinking it's a reference to Natasha Kinski, who was a internationally known supermodel at that time. Do you remember the famous, I think it was Richard Avedon. There was a famous poster of Natasha Kinski, who's naked, but her body is, she has a giant boa constrictor wrapped around her. You recall that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, my parents had that. So
my parents did not.
Yeah, they definitely did. So that wormed its way into my young boy psyche from a very early age.
Mm-hmm.
According to Ron, we had met Natasha Kinski through Giorgio. We used her name, although the song isn't about her. So we can put away the Natasha Kinski theories. Hate to disappoint.
Well, this song is probably one that has a little bit more depth than the others, than some of the others. I would hazard to say. It really is about trends, you know, and following trends and trying to assert your individuality and all of those things. I always thought it was very well done.
So who is Natasha in this story? Is she someone who refuses to go along with trends or fads or go along with the crowd?
I always assumed it was Natasha Kinski, even despite his denials.
Yeah.
Because she was so big right then for just a couple years.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at
seeing like the little nuances that you see sometimes.
So she's, well, I guess we can get into the lyrics more when we actually read those lyrics out loud.
Right.
Is there anything else musically? You'd mentioned David's drumming, of course, which is really interesting. So I'm going to be listening for that when we hear the song in just a moment.
Well, I guess I always wonder to myself how much on these records bands are actually in a studio playing together versus whether they're just taking tracks and adding them. Because when you hear this and Wacky Women and this whole album, really, it just, to me, has such a strong band sound. You know, it just sounds like guys playing this music. I wonder if that's really the case or not, but that's at least they are able to really give that impression of everybody.
Are you saying that because of the interplay that you hear?
Yeah.
I think that they did perform. I'll have to look it back up again. I was reading some interviews from Mac, and he does like to have a band perform at the same time and then putting some soundproofing, you know, walls or scrims or something.
Right, right.
Between them. So, interesting. I'm going to look into that and hopefully find out.
Well, do you hear that too? I mean, every song just sounds like a real band playing live.
It does.
This album was designed to get them back on the road.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think
one of the reasons why, maybe, hunch, you know, that so many songs bleed into each other is because, you know, they wanted to have a record that sounded like a, you know, 40-minute nonstop party.
Yeah.
Without any breaks. Sure. Yeah. That's not Natasha is in F major. What about Russ's voice? We haven't mentioned Russ's voice. You said something about Russ's voice on the last song. But on this one, he adopts this really weird, squeaky, whiny, squelchy type of voice.
He does. Yeah, no comment.
Yeah,
but
I don't either.
But his voice always works. It always works. Right. And it works perfectly well on this song, I would be the first to say.
But you brought up a really good point that Russ has a lot more room to stretch his vocal delivery on this album. And this is definitely an example of that. I don't know if he's ever used that sort of cartoony, squelchy voice on anything else, but it's entertaining to listen to.
Oh, I hear a lot from, you know, it seems like some people look at Sparks and they think of Ron and he is a genius. And I know I'm repeating myself from earlier episodes, but what Russell brings to it in my mind has always been just as important. And in just let's put it this way, maybe a little overlooked.
Yeah.
Maybe a little overlooked.
I'm with you.
Because the variety of styles that he adapts just on this album is astounding. It's so impressive. You know, you don't hear just the exact same voice throughout the whole thing. Every song, he brings some nuance to it and makes, you know, going back to the earlier point we were discussing about how there's a character in every one of these songs, he makes every one of these characters come alive.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah. And then at the end, it's just Russell. Hello, everybody. This is Russell.
I love that he brings it home. That he comes out at the end like some sort of master of ceremonies, concluding the night's show, right? Hello, everybody. This is Russell. I love it. I love that.
Well, you know, this is something I really haven't thought about. Wacky women. If he's an MC, he's told us about the little girl who has the pictures of Aunt Maureen, the woman who jumped off a bridge. Where's my girl? Who is this mystery woman that he's talking about? A Martian, you know, upstairs. Maybe that's Ron's contribution. Upstairs is a little different. But then every one of these songs, the Willies, maybe not so much. Don't Shoot Me, Susie Safety. That's not Nastasia. They're all about these different women, you know, I think we have two or three exceptions there, you know? Huh. And so at the end, our MC is just saying, wacky women, I love them.
To summarize, after hearing all these songs about various wacky women, wacky women are great. I had never thought of that.
I didn't either, but I love your comment about him coming. He's like the MC, bringing it home.
For the record, all of these songs are credited to Ron and Russell Mayall.
Yeah.
So that's not always the case. All right. Nastasia. Who's going to read these lyrics? Do you have them?
You can go ahead and read them. And I can read Wacky Women.
You got it.
Okay.
Man, there's never been a girl like this. That's not Nastasia. What an influential little miss. That's not Nastasia. Imitation is a form of flattery, I'm told. She is getting flattered where it's hot and where it's cold. That's not Nastasia. That's not Nastasia. That's not Nastasia. She is on the news again tonight. That's not Nastasia. Someone looking like her stole a... I think this is a misprint. She stole a bike. That's not Nastasia. Maybe it's a fad, a sort of modern hula hoop. Still, it's of their own free will. No one has been duped. That's not Nastasia. What a sense of power to have sway around the world. What a sense of power to control a billion girls. Change your hairstyle, they change theirs. Change your nail style, they change theirs. That's not Nastasia. See, now I am thinking about Nastasia Kinski. Presidential wives and topless maids, that's not Nastasia. More or less identically the same, that's not Nastasia. If I wasn't masculine, I would join the craze, dye my hair, and take on those Natasionic ways. That's not Nastasia. That's not Nastasia. Repeat. Now she wants some anonymity. That's not Nastasia. And all the rest want anonymity. That's not Nastasia. She should just forget it. It's a carbon copy world. When she starts to fade away, everyone will fade. That's not Nastasia, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds like Nastasia is some sort of a influencer. Could she be a supermodel?
She is. All the girls want to be. TikTok. She's got her own TikTok station and everything.
You know it. If anyone would, she would.
Oh, man.
Anything you want to add about this before we play the song?
Nah, I just don't know how somebody can write lyrics like this.
Yeah. All right, let her rip.
Imitation is a form of flattery, I'm told. She is getting flattered with
Okay, that was That's Not Nastasia, the penultimate song on Womp That Sucker. And we wrap things up with Wacky Women as Russ's way of summarizing the events of the preceding evening. This is obviously a really... it's definitely one of the funnest moments to me on the album. What a great way to go out.
I will go even further. I agree with that. I will say this is one of my very favorite Spark songs. It's just loud and funny. And, you know, in the first line, "Hello, everybody. This is Russell. Right before I sing, I'm going to make a muscle." Who knows what that's about? It's so silly and fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's them poking fun of his public persona, I guess. You know, he's the sexy one. He's the one who's in shape and svelte. I don't know.
And then all they like is sex and sitcoms. You know, try to be suave. They kick me in the
bonbons.
We'll go through the lyrics, but I mean, it's just so much fun. And I'll give you a little David Kendrick story here. I got a private drum lesson from him because at the end of when I think everybody knows I did interviews with David Kendrick and other Sparks drummers many years ago. And at the end of the interview, I said to him, "So tell me something about Wacky Women. That beat you do. Dun dun da da dun da da dun dun dun. Da da dun da da dun 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 da dun da da dun dun dun." I said, "When you do the double beat, the da da dun da da dun, right in a row there, were you doing that on the floor tom, or were you doing it on a tom-tom, you know, a hanging tom, or were you doing it with a bass drum?" And he told me, "Oh no, I was doing it on the tom-toms." And I was like, so relieved, because I just couldn't get it trying to do it on the floor tom, you know, on the bass drum. I just couldn't get it down.
It was a separate tom.
And once he said that, it was like something just broke and I was able to play it. So, you know, he basically uses that little rhythm, dun 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 dun. But then when they go into the "I'm Bananas Over," he goes into a more traditional drumming beat, and he kind of goes back and forth between the two of them. And then at the very end, he brings it home with "Whack Whack Wacky Wacky Women," and it all ends at the same. And he's using that beat, the dun 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 dun.
It's got a galloping quality to it.
Yeah. And it's some of my very favorite drumming. I love the guy. I love the song.
Are most of these songs, would you say they're in 4/4?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little, you know, That's Not Nastasia, I think, has a little break where they sway from 4/4. I don't even know. I'm looking at them. I don't know if there's anywhere else that they do. I'd have to listen to them again. But yeah, these are just straight 4/4 songs. And it's one of the things about Sparks is you very, very rarely hear that traditional drum beat of ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, you know, with the snare drum on the 2 and the 4.
Right.
But you do hear it on a couple songs here. And that's one of the things I kind of enjoy that. I kind of like when they let themselves be like other bands a little bit.
Man, thanks for mentioning that. Again, this is why I'm so grateful that you're a drummer. And by the way, private drumming lesson from David Kendrick. I mean, that's like a Make-A-Wish thing. That's incredible.
It was. Yeah, I just had to ask him how he did that beat, and he explained it to me, and just opened up the floodgates. And then I can play this song. I love drumming to this song. And it has. Go ahead.
No. Well, I was just gonna say I'm more versed in like melody and stuff.
Yeah.
So this is the only song, at least on this side, that's in a minor key, which combined with that martial galloping rhythm that you were talking about does give a kind of eerie. I wouldn't say menacing because it's too lighthearted for that, but there's sort of an eerie quality to this. I find it when I listen, and I think it's because this is in a minor key.
That's interesting. What I hear, you know, I notice it's at the very end of the album, and that gets to how I hear this is basically a live album because this is the big, loud closer, you know? And I think this they did when I saw them, I think this is how they closed the show, and then they took a break, and then they came back and did Upstairs. I don't remember that for sure, but that's how I kind of remember it. But, you know, it's big and it's loud and it's fun. And what I was going to mention, I have to give David Kendrick a little more credit. There's one point about 2/3 of the way in where he goes, whack, whack, wacky, wacky women. And then instead of like a traditional break, it's just on the ands. And that is, it's just a clever little thing that he throws in there. You know, normally it would be a da, 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 but he does it on the offbeats, the ands. And three, and four, and
which part of the song is it? Which part of the song? Which part?
Wacky Women, about 2/3 of the way down. This is a little place where he just does one measure.
Whack, whack, whack.
See, you probably wouldn't have noticed it.
I wouldn't.
Just like there's 1,000 synth parts that I am completely oblivious to, but you hear them.
So he's changing the beat with the emphasis.
He changes the emphasis from what you expect. You don't expect to hear it, but he changes it so it just gives a little bit of a different lilt to it. That's all.
That's awesome.
But it's just one of those wonderful little touches that either Ron or David decided to throw in there that stuck.
I'm looking forward to hearing a lot more of that when we get into Angst in My Pants. I'm going to let you have this one. This is yours, Wacky Women. For the lyrics and anything else, of course, that you wanted to add before doing so?
No, just hello, everybody. This is Russell. Right before I sing, I'm going to make a muscle. Now that's out of my system. Here's some Munchen wisdom. So I guess they're recording this in Germany, right?
Yes.
They're cool when they know it. Don't draw, you blow it. Whack, whack, wacky, wacky women. All they like is sex and sitcoms. Try to be suave, they kick me in the bonbons. What a great line. Medic, 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 medic. There goes my athletics. I'm bananas over. I'm bananas over. Whack, whack, wacky, wacky women. Right there is where they do it. Order in the court, and here's the charges. Under the influence of wacky women. How do you plead? Quit making muscles.
Great throwback.
Great line. Guilty, guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Have mercy, Your Honor. Show compassion, Your Honor. My feelings are genuine. Don't take me away from them. Don't take me away from them. Whack, whack, wacky, wacky women. money away from them. Whack, whack, wacky, wacky women. End. Album's over.
Exhumed. Awesome. Awesome. To set the stage for Angst in My Pants, which in many ways I feel like is a refinement of a lot of the things that they were doing on this album.
It is a refinement. Yeah. But it's consistent.
Yeah. So yeah. We'll be back soon to start talking about that album, which is one of my very, very favorites. It's pretty consistently in my top, I don't know, maybe top three of all of the the LPs. Was there anything that you
great album?
It is.
I think we covered it. You know, what is there left to say? I mean, it worked. It broke them out of the morass that they were in. It gave them a direction. You know, that was really their template for the next few years. You know, being in LA and making these rock albums and building their style and their brand again, which had been completely decimated with TJ. And yeah, it was just such a wonderful treat. Like I said, when we first talked about it, when I first heard it, it was just, wow, they're back.
Yeah.
They're back. This is Sparks. This is Now I'm Ready Again.
And, so, you know, thanks to K-Rock and Los Angeles, they had a new lease on life in their home country, or at the very least their hometown for a while. So they got to change their geographical focus for a few years there. And I'm sure that, you know, had to have some impact on the sounds that they chose to pursue in most of the 80s.
Yeah.
So much fun.
Yeah.
So much fun. All right. Well, Monty, as always, man, thank you so much for being here and for your insights. And I can't wait until we get together again to talk about Angst in My Pants.
Oh, Angst in My Pants.
Angst in My Pants.
What an album that one is.
You know it. All right.
All right.
Anything else you wanted to add before we call it a day?
No, thanks for having me. It's always so much fun.
You got it.
I love these conversations.
I do too. And look out for that link. I will be posting that link as soon as it's available to the Larry Graves conversation that we had on YouTube yesterday.
Sounds good. I will talk to you soon.
And with that, have a good evening, folks. Bye-bye.